Welcome to the Digital Underground podcast. This is a How I Got Here edition of the podcast, and I'm excited to have Marcus Rainham as my guest today. Someone I think I probably should have had on earlier, it's my oversight, but was suggested by our mutual friend Jack Daniels. So I'm excited to have Marcus on. Marcus, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule to do this with me.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
So, you know, obviously you don't need a whole bunch of introduction to people in the security community, but, you know, I'd love to hear kind of how you got started in computer security and, you know, maybe in technology to begin with. I know you kind of got in right at the beginning of what we consider kind of modern computer security, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, so I really wasn't particularly interested in security. At the time that I really touched, I like to think of getting involved in security as kind of like getting your necktie caught in power machinery. It just kind of sucks you in and never lets you go. I was interested in distributed systems more than anything else. And I was working as a pre-sales consultant at Digital Equipment Corporation. And my job there was, you know, I would rig up benchmark configurations or prototype some kind of a transaction system or, you know, whatever. And it was just a great job because every month I had a completely different challenge and project to work on, and I would get to go, you know, fart around and usually did okay solving the problem.
Yeah.
And one day my boss, Fred Avolio, said, you know, we're having some trouble with this guy who's been breaking into pieces of the network, and we need to upgrade the security on the internet gateways. And he chartered me with building an internet gateway like the guys in Palo Alto had and the guys in DEC Research in Cambridge had.
Yep.
And then, you know, that's when I discovered that actually there was nothing I could build that was like what either of them had, because they had something that was completely different. And I started trying to think through what exactly was going on with these internet gateways and what services were going back and forth and how they worked. And I went through this process of kind of organizing it all in my head, and I concluded that we really only needed to support, I think it was 5 key services, you know. And then I came up with the idea that we could make the security a lot better if we could throw all the users off the machine, which is kind of it's a great general rule for life, I think. My background prior to going to digital was a systems administrator. I was a systems admin at Johns Hopkins Hospital and at Gould and at university. So I hated users. And so That was really, for me, that was my big breakover moment where I started to think, you know, hey, this security stuff's not bad. It kind of allows you to organize your thoughts, and it requires a great deal of simultaneously organization and cleverness and simplicity. They all have to be there. And so that's when I started, I guess it was over Christmas vacation, I wrote a bunch of proxies and came up with this architecture for a firewall, which, you know, this is not really tremendous innovation. I stole ideas from Bill Cheswick and Steve Belevin at AT&T, who I gather stole ideas from Dave Prezzato and a couple of other smart people at AT&T. And I just, the thing that I did is I kind of took everybody's ideas that were floating at the time and then just polished them up and organized them and aligned them and packaged them and productized them. And that's how we got a firewall.
And you mentioned, you know, internet and internet gateways, and we should probably say, you know, at that time you could almost count the hosts that were on the internet probably, right?
It wasn't very big. It was a little hard to tell because a lot of people at the time were thinking of the internet and Usenet kind of interchangeably. So you had the huge cloud of people who were using UUCP, and then there were some people who were using UUCP over TCP and some over dial-up. So if you counted all those hosts, there was a large number. But, you know, we had Digital Equipment Corporation, which was a major computing company, and we had 3 internet gateways, which was a pretty big deal. The one up in Cambridge, I think, was connected via a T1 line. The one in Palo Alto was, I believe, two T1 lines to different locations, and then we had a 56 KB connection to University of Maryland's computing center.
And those, you know, for the people listening to this who were, you know, born in the 90s, those were super fast connections at the time.
Really fast. That was one of the first things that I kind of had to bump up against, is we really didn't know a lot about the bandwidth of what we could handle with a firewall. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I used the term gateway as slightly different from firewall because, for example, what Brian Reed, Paul Vixie, and the guys out in Deck West had was basically a gateway box, which was called gatekeeper.deck.com. And you, if you were one of Paul Vixie's friends, you could get an account on Gatekeeper, and you'd log in from the corporate side, and then you'd get out to the internet and do whatever you wanted because you had a shell access. And you can imagine the security of that was not, it wasn't bad because Paul watched over it very carefully. A lot of hoops in order to get access to that. But I didn't think that that was a successful paradigm for how to build a secure system, and there were security incidents on it. And so that's kind of, again, Paul and I had a very cheerful academic back and forth about the merits of getting all the users off the gateway, and there was some fighting about that, of course, because then it involved disempowering the users, as opposed to the model that I was promoting, where you know the user would say, "Well, I need shell level access," and then I could say, "Sorry, there's no shell on this machine."
Too bad.
Yeah, it doesn't work, you know. So the model of being able to say it doesn't work was very nice. And then, of course, there was the it's going to be slow because you're going to have to actually copy all the data from one side and then do stuff to it and then push it back out the other. So the first thing I did was a bunch of measurements, and then the other thing I did was I looked at the bandwidth usage of real users, and I discovered that people behind the firewall generally produced a very small amount of data, whereas people on the outside or responses to that was fairly large. So I put these rate limiters in so that if somebody was trying to export a tarball source code, it would simply normalize it down to about 1.2K per second. But if you were FTPing data in, it would run at the full blazingly fast 56K per second. And, you know, I still think that that paradigm would probably be a good one to have enforced across the community going forward. You know, I still shake my head and kind of groan when I hear about people who get rooted and then they have terabytes of data leak out through their internet connection. And I'm just thinking, man, you know, if the reason you got this internet connection is so people can surf the web, you should normalize it so that URIs can go out really easily, but terabytes of business documents can't. Mm-hmm. This isn't rocket science.
No, that's something people have been looking at for a long time, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So what was the reaction when, you know, from users and that sort of thing, when the, you know, you guys started deploying those first firewalls?
It wasn't too bad. Most people were just happy to be able to send and receive email with the outside world. That all worked automatically. It didn't require anything. We just had to tell people, you know, here's how you convert your corporate internal address to an external email address, and now you can give it to your kid when he's away at college. And there were a lot of people who used that to sign up to mailing lists and so forth, and that's how I discovered, you know, my first instance of what happens when a list goes into a loop. fun things like that. Because I used to just sit there and watch the, you know, one of the things that's nice about these slow firewalls is you could sit there and just watch the syslog scroll by. There was actually a time when you could do syslog analysis using, you know, Mark I human eyeball. At 56K, it's actually possible. You can also do intrusion detection with TCP dump and stuff like that. But the reaction was fairly favorable. There was a bill of services and stuff like that. One of the first things that came up was a lot of people said, well, we want our own firewall. And that was kind of how the thing started getting packaged. And then one of our more aggressive sales guys sold one to DuPont, And so, you know, I got, since I was in a pre-sales organization, you know, they had heard about this stuff. And so I got the, you know, hey, do you want to go install a firewall at DuPont? By the way, we sold one. So there I was, you know, with my little rack of deck stations next to this Cray YMP supercomputer in a data center at DuPont installing Alteryx and just laughing my ass off. And that was our first firewall sale. And from there it went to, you know, Exxon, and there were a lot of big companies in those days who were first starting to try to figure out how to hook things up.
Sure.
And sure. Because of the way, you know, everybody just picked IP address ranges. And if they had some Sun workstation, Sun's installer would start to install you on Sun's IP address range. So there were huge corporations that you literally couldn't connect to the internet directly because they would have had to readdress all of their entire IP cloud.
Oh, jeez.
And the architecture that I had come up with, because it was inherently based on proxies, it inherently did network address translation. So that worked very nicely. Then we were able to just tell people, oh, no, you're not going to have to readdress your whole network. You just drop this thing in. As long as people can talk to the inside, they can talk to the outside. It just worked. It was very nice.
And what did the firewalls that you guys, you know, those early ones that you were selling, what did they physically look like? What were you installing? I can't even imagine.
Okay. So since this is kind of a, you know, no kidding, there I was stories. I'm going to tell one piece of this that's kind of embarrassing to me.
Excellent.
Because I worked for a vendor, I was not light-handed about the hardware that was used.
Sure. Yeah.
and that's kind of embarrassing. I mean, honestly, it could have been done with one box. But we sold a three-box architecture, and the reason we sold a three-box architecture actually was because we were a vendor that sold hardware, but also realistically, I did think it was a good design point to have different pieces of the system performing different kinds of work. So there was a front-end box that did some packet filtering that kind of conditioned packets and did some analysis that then allowed the traffic through to the middle box that was the gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper was the box that was running all of the proxies. And really the reason for that design was because I was afraid that, I wanted to sell deck stations, but also I was afraid that the box in the middle it would be best if it wasn't doing packet whacking as well as proxying. I just thought that dividing the load up rationally kind of made some sense. So then there was the box in the middle with the proxies, and one of the things that the middle box would do was email would just punch straight through to the third box in the back, which was sort of the mail processing and forwarding box, and it was just running an instance of Paul Vixie's King James Sendmail, which was a version of Sendmail with a bunch of bugs removed and some new bugs added by Paul. So people could set that up as their mail forwarder. And so that just did send mail processing. So, you know, I kind of balanced the load across these three boxes. So what it looked like was three deck stations, usually 5,000s or 3,000s. We started off mostly with 3,000s.
Mm-hmm.
Three deck stations and a small multi-port Ethernet repeater. And then on the outside of that, you would have a router. And then on the inside of that, you'd have usually a fat Ethernet cable back into your corporate backbone someplace. And again, these were all, you know, routed networks that we were talking about.
Right.
So frequently, you know, that external box was the demilitarized zone network, and then if you wanted to add more things to it, that was another piece of the architecture that I kind of liked, is you could just plug more stuff into that demilitarized zone. If you had an FTP server or something that you wanted to have on the outside periphery of your company, remember there weren't web servers yet, so
right.
That whole issue hadn't exploded.
So at that point, what kind of threats were, you know, the people that you were selling these firewalls to even worried about? Like, what were their main concerns at that point?
Same concerns we've got nowadays. There's the only change between the security threat model in those days and the security threat model we've got nowadays is, you know, back, if you go back to the greatcircle.com firewalls mailing list, you know, you'll see emails between me and Paul Robertson hypothesizing about, quote, firewall breakers, end quote. The idea being you'd get some kind of a penetration tool on someone's desktop that would be going out through the firewall and allow traffic back in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in 1989, that was still a hypothetical. Now it's the reality of most of what's going on because, you know, desktops are still extremely penetrable. And by the way, you know, in 1989, we were solving that problem simply by requiring outgoing authentication. So you had to use a cryptographic authenticator to log into the firewall, and it would unlock your firewall use for an hour or 2 hours or 6 hours or whatever the time was. So, you know, much of what we would see as modern malware wouldn't really be a problem. Of course, the problem would be complaining users, and complaining users are a much bigger problem than getting rooted on a regular basis, apparently.
Yeah.
People were concerned about someone getting in and stealing source code and sending it out or browsing around inside the network. You know, at the time that I was building this stuff, Kevin Mitnick was up knocking around in the networks up in the Massachusetts part of Digital Equipment Corporation. Apparently, mm-hmm. he was going after certain pieces of the VMS source code. And I was, you know, happy and fortunate at the time that he didn't try to do anything with my firewall. I'd like to imagine that it's because he took one look at it and was scared, which is probably not the case. I think he probably just, you know, preferred to use the higher bandwidth connections elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that started to become a problem because we started to think about, you know, what's going to happen if everybody starts putting their own firewalls in and then the company's got tons and tons of internet gateways. How are we going to manage that process? And, you know, so nowadays that's something that IT just kind of understands is an issue. You don't want just every, you know, you don't want the sales guys to just go buy and install their own firewall, right? They'll come up with a policy for it. You know, so my boss, Fred Avolio, and Wynn Treese up at Cambridge Research Lab and a couple other people basically conspired, and they created this non-existent committee. I guess it's okay for me to out this now. But they came up with this committee called XARC, which was the External Access Request Control Committee. And so when somebody said, you know, could you give us a tarball of your firewall code because we want to install a firewall, Fred would say, sure, no problem, just fill out your XARC form. And then they'd get this form that was basically, you know, what's your business justification for this, who's sure. responsible, who's putting their job on the line if there's a security vulnerability, you know, and then we would just grind them into bureaucratic hell until they went away.
That's an excellent old government trick. And, you know, big companies love that stuff too, which it's, you know, DEC is one of those companies that, you know, is kind of gotten lost in the mists of, you know, internet history over the years. But, you know, I'm up in the Boston area, and there's still, you know, a lot of people in floating around who worked at DEC at one point or another and still have very fond memories of that place.
The internet was written on DEC stuff.
Yep.
You know, Berkeley Unix was basically designed for, Unix was designed for DEC stuff. Berkeley Unix specifically designed for DEC stuff. All of the first internet gateways and so forth were designed for DEC stuff. You know, in fact, I think that the reason that there was probably any portability at all between big Endian and little Endian architectures in Unix was probably because of the DEC versus Sun byte order issues.
And so after you did your tour at DEC and all of that, what was your, it couldn't have been too long after that that the large companies started springing up that decided that selling firewalls was a, you know, $100 million business.
I'm trying to figure out if you hear a thunking sound, that's me banging my head against the wall while I'm recalling all this kind of stuff. So some friends of mine that I used to work with at Gould had gone to this little startup in Falls Church, And digital at that point was, the deck was tilting and water was pouring in over the gunnels. And Fred Avolio went to Trusted Information Systems, which is this little security consultancy in Glenwood, Maryland. And Fred said, I bet I could get you a job here. And then I talked to my friends at the startup in Falls Church, and they had this thing that they were calling the Land Guardian, which was going to be an integrated firewall encryption box. And I kind of talked to them, and they wanted somebody to be basically the product manager, program manager for Land Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And build this box, and they were going to sell it with internet connections. And I didn't like the way that was staffed and managed, and I was afraid it was going to turn into one of those, you know, hey, let's invade Russia kind of projects. So I went to Trusted Information Systems, and instead I could have been employee number 30 at UUNet.
Oh man, that's
which means, you know, no offense, but if I had gone to UUNet, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now because
no,
I would be
not.
On a beach. I would be on a beach someplace trying to see, you know, well, trying to see how much money I could spend that day. But I, you know, I will say Land Guardian never was much of a success. Although maybe if I'd gone there, because right, their model was that they were going to sell a Land Guardian with every internet connection where the customer asked about security. Cha-ching.
Oh man.
But I didn't like the basic system architecture, and I didn't like the way the software had been developed for it, and I was very concerned about that because, you know, my idea at the time was let's license some version of Unix, and their idea was let's use an embedded operating system like QNX or Wind River or something like that. And I didn't think at the time that an embedded operating system was the way to go, and it just looked like a disaster. So I went to Trusted Information Systems instead. And my first job at TIS was, I was very excited about it. I was going to be working on the Trusted Mock project. They had a mock kernel, and they were funded by the NSA to turn that into an evaluatable version of a secure Unix operating system. And I spent about 3 hours looking at the mock kernel and was just reeling with horror at the code and the design. It was very well marketed as this microkernel architecture, and it was terrible. I mean, it was just scary. The build was scary. The code was scary. Everything about it was scary. And I was seriously thinking about quitting and going back, you know, trying to see if I could revive things at UUNet again. I'm beating my head against the wall here. When our CEO got a call from DARPA saying, do you have anybody there who knows anything about firewalls? And so Fred Avolio and I got dragged into Steve Walker's office to do a conference call with DARPA. And DARPA said that, you know, President Clinton wants to put the White House on the internet. Do you know anything about firewalls? And I said a bit. You know, you get those kind of career-defining moments. And so I can't remember what I was doing, but I stayed up all night and I wrote this paper that basically was an outline for a proposal for how to, you know, how to do security for the White House, including not just a firewall. I just referenced some of my earlier papers about firewalls, it also taking a version of Kermit, which was the default terminal emulator at the time, and building a server version of Kermit that, you know, did encryption in line. So I was basically trying to build, you know, what nowadays we would call SSL Kermit, except I was trying to build Kermit with an authenticator in it. And then they were big Macintosh fans, so the whole idea is we were going to build this for Mac, and we were going to build it for DOS and Unix. And so I wrote this whole kind of architecture up and showed it to Steve the next morning. And then that went to DARPA, and boom, suddenly I was the technical lead on this project. And Fred Avolio, again, was my manager, which was great because I always loved working for Fred. Suddenly, you know, I was building the firewall for the White House, and that was a lot of fun.
So that would have been mid to late 90s time frame?
I think it was 92 around there. Oh,
okay. Okay, so even earlier on.
I can't remember when Clinton got elected.
But it was 92, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, yeah. And so as things started kind of evolving in the 90s with, you know, the advent of the commercial web and all that kind of stuff, did you at that point think, all right, you know, somebody's going to need to be securing all this stuff? Or were you kind of sitting back looking at like, okay, they're building a whole bunch of crap and just throwing it up there. Like, is anyone thinking about security at any point?
Yeah. So my attitude towards security has always been, well, through the early part of my career, it's always been, I'm a toolsmith. I'm not a policy guy. My job is I will make you the best possible rope for you to hang yourself with. right? So, I mean, hey, seriously, if I'm going to make, you know, if my job is to make the rope, I'm going to make a really, really good rope. And it's not really up to me to tell you what to do. And, you know, when the web first came out and people first started pulling down, you know, NCSA, the NCSA, what the heck was it? I keep wanting to say Looking Glass, but that's not it. Looking Glass was the first commercial browser, I think, Spyglass. But anyway, so they started making that thing. And, of course, we started getting requests for an HTTP proxy. And at that point, we had started spinning up this whole firewall venture, and we're commercializing it. And Peter Churchyard programmed a web proxy. So suddenly I found myself with a team of people. And I wasn't the manager. Fred was the manager, but I was the technical lead. And so that was kind of a really good segue into managing other people, because I wasn't really the boss, but I was the technical boss. So mm-hmm. I got to discover how unpleasant it is to have people that are, you know, have other people that you're responsible for getting to do the right things. But so our view was that we were just building tools. We had this, you know, absolutely fantastic engineer, Wei Shu, whose English wasn't particularly great at the time, and I decided that he was going to write an encryption layer in packet-level encryption, just fixed-key stuff, using a ported version of John Ioannidis's Swipe and using a hardware encryption board. And we were thinking, well, for corporations that want to build a virtual network perimeter, is what we were calling it, if you want to build a virtual network perimeter, we can punch the packets encrypted across the internet. So we were thinking about that kind of thing.
Okay.
We were realizing that companies needed tools to build security architectures, but I was staying very far away from the architectural role, because, you know, the other way I remember at the time, the way I used to think about it was that I was a seatbelt salesman. I was designing the best seatbelts I could for the car, but if you wanted to tie the seatbelt around your neck, there wasn't anything I could do to stop you from doing that.
Right.
And that's really kind of how my opinion formed there around 1992 and has stayed there ever since, which is that, you know, I'm trying to build tools that work and people use them in really stupid ways, and that's not my problem.
That's a trend that's continued over the last 20 years.
Yeah, well, I realized it was going to be an absolutely hellacious problem, because we had one of the guys who was associated with the team, Dave Dalva, and we asked Dave to do kind of a code review of some of the NCSA web browser, which was the one that Mark Andreessen and his guys had written.
Yep. Mosaic.
Just take a look at that thing, because the idea was, when we write the proxy that's going to go back and forth through the, you know, that's going to proxy the data through the firewall, it should take into account something about what we can learn about the data going back and forth. And Dave found that, you know, what the telnet URLs would do is it would just take the telnet URL and it would strip the telnet off the front, and then it would do a system on whatever was, you know, stick the word telnet back in front and then do a shell command for whatever it was handed back from the server. And, you know, Dave comes running into my office going, hey, you've got to see this. This is the worst code I've ever seen. And I said, you know, is it worse than the mock kernel? And he said, absolutely. And, I had my undivided attention at that point. And, and so we started to realize that there was going to be a problem with all these new applications that were coming on. And, you know, the age of shovelware was not quite upon us yet, but that was the first moment where I started to realize that this was going to be a really big problem. One of the things that we used to do in the proxies that was a big selling point for the proxies was that, you know, we would analyze a protocol that was going back and forth and think about, you know, is this really what this protocol should do? So when I wrote the FTP proxy, for example, I pretty quickly figured out that FTP bounce attacks were going to be a problem. And at the time when I was doing that, you know, because writing an FTP proxy is a nasty piece of work. You got sockets hanging all over the place. And I realized that since the FTP daemon was bound to a low port, that you could actually FTP the client side of an RSH request to the RSH report on another machine, and it would come from FTPD, which was a low order port, and it would just go straight through.
Nice.
Yeah. So I sent some emails to some people at Berkeley who owned that code, and I got that fixed without telling anybody. And then I mitigated that problem in the FTP proxy. And I didn't even talk about it because in those days I didn't think, and I still do, I still don't think that the hackers need to know about these tricks. And so I just fixed that and let it sit for 5 or 6 years. And then at one point, somebody came up with the idea of FTP bounce attacks and was kind of surprised to notice that the Berkeley code said, you know, the Berkeley code for RSHD was checking to make sure that it wasn't bound to the FTP port, huh? You know, so yeah, it was an interesting time because those of us who lived through that era, you know, you remember, I don't know if you did it, I was in Dallas at Sterling Software, which was a client of mine at the time, when Netscape went public.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And you just watched that stock ticker go up like a Saturn V rocket. And you went, wow, the market is rewarding people for getting stuff out the door.
Yeah.
The market is not rewarding people for writing stuff that's good. They're just rewarding people for getting stuff out the door. And that was when I turned to Kent Landfield, who I was working for at the time, and I said, the age of shovelware is upon us. And it's still there.
Oh, yeah. That was the beginning of, you know, like the participation medal kind of era where, you know, you get a trophy and you get a trophy. Everybody gets a trophy for, you know, building some software.
Well, if you get it out the door badly, you know, and so the problem,
quickly
the problem
enough.
With the, yeah, well, the problem with the Netscape IPO was it absolutely cemented this idea that if you can get market share and time to market, you can worry about making your software good and functional later. And, of course, nobody ever did go back and make it good or functional.
Yeah, very, very few people. Very few. Because, yeah. I mean, you've already been rewarded, so what's the point in going back and fixing it?
Exactly. And then the other piece of that mindset that kind of kicks in is, well, you know, we've got 2 million users now. We can't change the way any of this stuff works.
Right.
And so if you make a protocol mistake, I mean, I've kind of ranted about this a couple of times. I did a TEDx talk a bunch of years ago where I pointed out that, you know, the whole reason that we have internet firewalls that work the way they do is because of that weird callback thing that FTP does.
Yeah.
And so I started digging around to find, you know, well, who wrote FTP? You know, well, FTP goes back to Multics and then and then, you know, you talk to Tom Van Vleck or some of the Multics guys, and you say, why? What the hell? And they go, oh, you know, the reason that FTP works that way is because it was written for NCP. And at this point, I'm scratching my head going, what the hell is NCP? Oh, NCP was the thing before TCP, and you could only have data go one way on a socket. So if you think about this, the reason we have firewalls is because of a backwards compatibility issue going back to pre-Multics days. I mean, we're talking code from 1978 here. And you know, the rational thing would have been, you know, for somebody in 1980 to take that old code out back like old Yeller and just shoot it and then write a new version of a communications layer that, you know, maybe had encryption and authentication built in, and we wouldn't have all this, you know, horrific crap that we've got nowadays with SSL and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, which is funny because considering we're recording this the morning after the latest SSL TLS bug was.
Oh, see, I slept through that one.
Oh, good. You can pick it up later.
But since this is being recorded for posterity, I will make a nasty point about SSL, which is going to make maybe lose me a friend or two. But you know, one of the things I've learned the hard way is that you have to look at the purpose for which something was built. And if you don't really understand that purpose, you're never going to really understand the context of that thing very well. And what you need to understand about SSL is that SSL was not really designed to actually be the secure e-commerce protocol that everything works over top of. The purpose of SSL was to allow public key partners to monetize the RSA patents. That was it. They came up with that whole halfway public key authentication system thing so that RSA could sell a ton of certificates through VeriSign. And that also, SSL did exactly what it was supposed to do. If what SSL was supposed to do was secure the internet, we'd have something that actually did bidirectional authentication using a security hierarchy with certificate revocation, but we don't have that.
No, we do not. And as you said with the you know, talking about the IPO era, it's far too late to go back and unwind that mess too.
Well, there's also the question of, you know, would the government have actually allowed that? But you know, back to thinking about the purpose and the consequences of making these kinds of decisions, I mean, if there had been something that was kind of like SSL that actually did bidirectional authentication, why not throw perfect forward secrecy in as well? That would have been very easy. All you'd have to do is, you know, just do PFS. Well, you can imagine how unhappy the NSA would be with that. And that would have never gotten exported, and it would have never gotten approved. So you get this paradoxical condition in which the very fact that the government allowed SSL to happen is proof that SSL sucks butt. and if you think about that, you know, again, security people like me, I think that probably the first time that these words passed my lips was probably about 1989, which was passwords are obsolete, right? I don't know if you've ever heard a security person say that before.
Once or twice.
But the only thing that SSL has done for us is continued the existence of passwords 20 zombie-like years past the point at which it should have died.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
Because if we, you know, and now we are finally getting to the point, which is, you know, again, this is surreal and bizarre, but we're finally getting to the point where everybody has a really nice offline handheld authentication calculator, namely their cell phone. Mm-hmm. And some people are just starting to realize, hey, we could use this to authenticate. Why, yes, you can. That's a great idea. You know, I mean, a lot of this software needs to be just taken out and shot and replaced with something that was not developed beholden to a business, financial, or political agenda. And, you know, we absolutely should have systems. Yeah, see, the thing that's crazy, if you think about it, we could just do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange, drop into high-quality encryption, and exchange a username and password over that.
Right.
It's so much simpler than SSL. I mean, the only problem is RSA doesn't get to make any money off of it anymore.
Right. Who gets to sell certificates then?
Yeah. And because you can sell certificates, you've got this situation where now you've got governments who are in the business of selling certificates. You know, governments have a tremendous amount of leverage with the people who sell certificates because their intelligence agencies need to be able to do man-in-the-middle attacks. And, you know, There were, I don't think I could cite specific ones or dig them up because it would probably not be appropriate, but I probably have emails from the early 1990s where we were going, you know, the government's going to get into the government's going to make sure it's in the middle of the public key business. And then now, thanks to Edward Snowden, we discovered that we were more right than we ever realized.
So right. Yeah. Very, very right. And, you know, so after you got to go through the all of this with the firewall business and all of that sort of thing, You kind of went through it again with the IDS business about a decade later.
Yep. Well, I kind of when I left TIS, I consulted for a while, and then I went to a startup in Rockville called V1, which was doing an authenticated transaction layer, kind of like SSL tied to smart cards. And we got that thing public, so I got to do my first and only IPO roadshow, which was a very interesting experience. I don't recommend. We got that one public, and then I left and started Network Flight Recorder, which was not intended to be an intrusion detection company. But you know, so I was the CEO of NFR until 2001, I guess it was. So 97 to 2001. So I got to do the whole thing of, you know, raising capital and writing business plans. I did that whole little capitalist dream for a little while there, which mm-hmm. is unbelievably unpleasant. It was very frustrating because the original design of the Network Flight Recorder is sort of kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's, you know, the closest product you've got nowadays to what NFR was intended to be was the Nixon packet collector thing. So my idea was to collect packets and then retroactively go dig through them and look for patterns and generate statistics and do anomaly detection and a bunch of stuff like that. And at that time, there was a company called Wheel Group that had taken some shell scripts and stuff that they'd written as part of an incident response at Rome Labs for the Air Force and turned it into an intrusion detection system, which got bought by ISS and became the ISS Real Secure.
Yeah.
And so suddenly, while we were trying to build this kind of high-integrity data vault plus analytic engine, all I kept getting was questions from our customer about, well, how many signatures do you have compared to ISS Real Secure? And, you know, when you're in business and you've got customers, you know, and you know, they all want to buy ropes to hang themselves with, and you keep, you know, there's only so long that you can tell those customers, no, really, you don't want rope to put around your neck. You want a step ladder so that you can do this safely. Mm-hmm. After a while, you just say, screw it. You know, it's $5 a yard. How much rope do you want? And so we were forced into the intrusion detection market by the market. Because nobody was buying what we were interested in selling, because everybody was just chasing the latest thing. And that was an amazing learning experience for me. I mean, in terms of turning me cynical and jaded about the industry.
Yeah.
It made me realize in a profound way that's hard to even convey just how totally fad-driven and thoughtless computer security has become. And that was very difficult because when I first started out in security, the only people who did security were the people who really got it and the people who really cared about it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that 1998, 1999 had rolled around, the security industry had Gartner analysts following it. We'd had IPOs. There was big money, and there were people who were, you know, making quote products end quote that were basically a user interface with nothing behind the engine and selling them and making millions and millions of dollars. So I spent kind of a couple of years chasing the capitalist buck until I decided that actually I don't like capitalism very much. I tried to kind of keep my focus as far as doing stuff that's interesting to me.
And so these days, now that you're at Tenable and have been for a little while, what kind of projects are you working on now that are keeping your interest?
Well, so at Tenable, I'm in a kind of an interesting spot. My original gig at Tenable was as the CSO. Of course, we're going through a huge period of growth, which is really awesome because, you know, we brought in a bunch of capital and we're growing the company really big. And so the company's been, you know, it's went from self-funded, and I think there were probably 20 people when I came, and now there's, you know, pushing close to 200, 300 people. I was doing everything on the kind of the teaching side and customer outreach back when I started.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still big on the customer outreach, But my arrangement with the company is that I kind of get to think about other stuff. So I get to do blogging where I can try to put out ideas that I think are useful to the community. And I've also done a couple of research projects, which I'm quite confident will go absolutely nowhere. a couple years ago, I wrote a variation of the old NFR idea for anomaly detection using a scoring system. So I implemented a scoring system for a friend of mine when he was working at a biotech out in LA. And we implemented that, and it worked pretty well. And we did some papers that got published about it, and then it just sort of sank without a trace because, the hyper-commercialization and faddishness of the industry has pretty much ruined the ability for anyone to do any kind of really useful research in security. When I look at the academic research that's going on in security, it's painfully non-commercializable because, basically the money that's gotten injected into the industry has caused this division between, if it's something commercializable, people run out and try to raise money and do a startup and make their millions and buy a Ferrari. And if it's not, then it's left for the academic researchers. So you get these kind of weird papers and you go, huh, look, somebody wasted 2 years of their life on that. That's really tragic. So I'm trying to keep doing stuff that's real. And at this point, because the kind of code that I used to write, kids these days look at it and go, what? There's no graphical user interface. It's weird. It's written in KNRC, if it doesn't use XML, so the stuff that I write is pretty much useless. So at this point I go around trying to tell people ideas, hey, if you were thinking about this or you're thinking about that, here's an idea that if you want to run with it, you might be able to make millions because I really don't care. Not that I'm rich. It's just that I discovered that the process of trying to get rich is so painful. It just turns you into a nasty person. It's much better to be comfortably well off. than to get on the rat race, because the problem with being in a rat race is you got to be a rat.
That's a fair point. Yeah, and it never seems like anybody wins that race either.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a few people who win, and mainly the people who win are the capitalists. I was doing a talk. I do a lot of outreach talks, which are just basically I'm just trying to help people think about this stuff. I did a talk at I think it was University of New York, and somebody in the question, because I made a dismissive comment about capitalism and security, and someone said, well, what do you do about it? And I wound up rattling off a couple of ideas for how you could do non-capitalist businesses in the security space. Mm-hmm. And, it's always tempting to do these kinds of things, but, I'm 53 now, and I've finally come to the realization that if you're somebody like me who's always bubbling up ideas, that you just have to acknowledge that you're not going to do everything. So there's no point in saving an idea for yourself, because the list of ideas that I've had that sounded interesting that I'm never going to do is much longer than the list of things that I've done. Yeah. And it's vastly longer than the list of things that I will do in the time left to me. Not that I'm planning on dying soon, but it's just, I've only got, another 20 good years maybe of technical life if I stay sharp and work hard at it. Mm-hmm. And if I really kicked ass for the next 20 years, which I have no intention of doing, but if I really kicked ass for the next 20 years, I still wouldn't be able to do half of what I'd like to do.
Yeah.
So, you just kind of go, oh, well, okay, here's some rope, kid, go play in the tree.
Right. And there's plenty of rope to go around.
Yep. Well, I know I sound cynical and jaded, and the reason is because I'm really cynical and jaded.
Sure.
here we're talking about an industry in which complexity is our enemy. And then you see these people, and they're building a security problem, and what do? They build in an XML parser that was written by some open source project, and it's 300,000 lines of code. And I go, wow, you know, the first firewall that I sold was under 10,000 lines of code. And there's actually a funny point to that. I mean, I'm not saying that lines of code is a perfect metric of whether something is simply implemented or not. There's, you know, but software security, by the way, is the next area where I think people really need to put some brain power down. But I remember one time I had this idea when I first started coding the proxies that your code should not be more complicated than a smart person should be able to review in an afternoon, because otherwise no one's ever going to review it. And, you know, who on earth would field a security product without having at least some kind of a code review on it? Huh, right? I was still a little naive.
Yeah. Turns out lots of people will do that.
Yeah, and they'll make a lot of money doing it. So so what? So I sent a copy of my FTP proxy with the bounce detection blocking stuff in that to Bill Cheswick, who happened to have an afternoon free. And Ches looked through my code, and, you know, the next morning I opened my email, and there were three patches from Ches, because he had found, you know, what we now know as a buffer overrun condition in some of my code. So there is value to being able to do reviews on the code. And so, you know, all this stuff that people are running that are these huge, massive architectures, they're stuff that are incomprehensible, and of course they're going to be unsecure, you know. And that was when I started having that realization. That was around the time when I started being extremely dismissive of IPv6. I mean, look how long it's taken for us to get IPv4 to the point where it doesn't just crawl and fall over if you give it a badly crafted packet.
Right.
You know, IPv6 is going to be a gift that just keeps on giving.
For many years to come.
Well, you know, that one's actually really easy to fix, but I don't know if it's ever going to get fixed. Back in the early 90s, I think it was, Andrew Molitor, when he was at Network Systems Corp, he and I suggested that what we do is just put a 64-bit address in, use IPv4, go to a 64-bit address, and left fill with zeros, bump the version number, and rock on. Call it, you know, IPv5.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the guys at the IETF who wanted to write their own new protocol so they could be the next Vint Cerf or whatever, they were horrified by that extremely childish suggestion and, you know, shot the idea down extremely quickly by saying, you know, oh, there'd be too many routes for the backbone routers to handle, blah, 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 which is, of course, all bull, because, you know, CIDR block routing hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, people at that time were saying, oh, my God, you'd have to have a gigabyte of memory in a router. That's impractical. Really?
Yeah.
by the time that it would have mattered, gigabyte of memory in a core router would have been available. The problem would have solved itself. Instead, we're going to have IPv4 with NAT for a very, very, very long time. That's one thing that's kind of frustrating. If I kind of go back, you know, just to focus on the commercialism of stuff, I probably could have patented the first proxy firewall the way that I did it. Not that I would necessarily would have been innovative, but I probably could have gotten a patent for it. I've got to phrase that very carefully. I'm not saying that this was a great idea. I'm saying the patent system is broken. That's what I'm saying. But I probably could have gotten a patent for network address translation.
Oh, I think so. I mean, some of the patents that people have these days, oh, yeah.
Well, that's a funny thing. I mean, you know, sort of the patent system being broken, I want to complain about it, but it is the gift that keeps on giving for me, because I keep getting calls from attorneys who want me to, you know, help them do research for some firewall patent. I mean, I've seen companies that are getting granted patents for stateful packet inspect, what Checkpoint calls stateful packet inspection,
mm-hmm.
in 2006. And you just go, really?
Wow.
I mean, well, what they do is they don't call it stateful packet inspection. They come up with some new set of terms that get past a patent examiner. You know,
patent,
you know, patent examiners don't get paid enough to be good at this. The patent examiners that are good are become patent lawyers working for outside firms trying to defeat the patent system. So we get these pernicious reward structures that cause the system to go worse and worse off the rails. But, you know, I like it because they call me up and go, can we retain you as a consultant? And I go, sure, here's a rate card. And then, you know, I read a bunch of patents and then I have a good laugh and a drink of wine. And then I call them up and I tell them, here's where all the prior art on that one's buried. And they say, thank you. And that's it.
That sounds like a nice gig. I like that.
It is a nice gig, although, you know, I look at those kinds of things and I think, man, you know, I probably... So back when I was at Digital, there was this guy, I think it was Jeffrey Onions was his name, and he wrote a user mode packet driver that had an internal packet injector. So it was basically like dev packet. And you'd send a packet to dev packet, and it would go out through the routing layer. So I wrote a shell script that ran on top of Onions' packet driver that would collect packets and encrypt them, and then you encode them and email them to another device, which would just re-inject them. Boom, VPN.
Oh,
I could have patented. I could have patented that. I could have owned VPNs.
Jeez.
I mean, now realistically, there were other things that were doing in, you know, link level encryption. I'm not saying that I actually invented anything useful, but I probably could have, if the patent had been scoped correctly, right? I probably could have patented the idea of encrypting, embedding, and de-embedding TCP or, you know, IP packets. And that would have been good enough, you know?
Oh, I think so. That might have been a useful patent, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, when I think of these kinds of things, I have a mental dodge that I use, which makes myself feel better about it, which is if I had made millions and millions of dollars, I'm a really bad driver. And I love technology. So if I had made millions of dollars, I probably would have bought a Lamborghini and killed myself by now. I would be wrapped around a tree someplace, you know, and then they would have this bronze sculpture of a Lamborghini wrapped around a bridge abutment with a little plaque saying, you know, this is the memorial to the successful software engineer.
Somewhere on 495, there'd be an overpass with your name on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I actually did own a sports car for a short period of time after the V1 IPO. Until I actually discovered that owning a sports car really sucks.
Well, I mean, it's kind of mandatory. If you have a software IPO, you're supposed to do that.
That's right. And that's what I did. You know, although, you know, I was smart about it. I bought a used Acura NSX and I drove it for a bunch of years and I sold it for practically what I paid for it. So,
oh man, I love that car. Oh.
It's a 95 NSXT, bright red. And I, you know, had custom seats done, seat leathers done for it. And it was just a badass car. And the problem was it actually did nearly kill me because I had a radiator puncture in my little Honda Del Sol. It was my daily driver. And so I drove the Acura for a week and a half to and from work. And I got in the habit of just hammering through these little back roads in upstate in Maryland up north at Rockville.
Yeah.
And I would be going 85, 90 miles an hour through these little roads.
Oh, gosh.
And when I got the Del Sol back, I tried to take the road at 85, just like I... Yeah. So I flipped the thing end over end twice.
Oh.
And survived. But I'm not kidding when I say, A, I'm a bad driver, and B, they would have a little memorial, because they damn near did. I flipped the thing end over twice and then hit an oak tree.
Oh, God.
And fortunately, I hit it with the undercarriage of the car up against the oak tree. And
holy shit.
And at that time, I was so wrapped up in my corporate lifestyle. You know, this is what I mean. You know, being really into this whole corporate thing, it just turns you into a nasty person unless you're a saint to begin with. And I'm not a saint. I was a pretty nasty person at the time. You know, so I called up my wife at the time. I said, you know, could you get, get the Acura and come pick me up because I just wrecked the Honda and I need to get to this meeting right away, you know.
Yeah.
So she comes in the Acura. I jump in. And as I'm about to blast off to get to my meeting, because I'm now 5 minutes late, I see her throwing up at the sight of what was left of my Honda.
Oh, man.
And,
yeah.
You know, Yeah, and that was a reality check for me, because then I started thinking, you know, why am I doing this again?
Yeah.
This isn't fun, you know. It's really not fun.
That does not sound like fun, considering,
and then,
you know.
Yeah. And then how many people, you know, if you go to, you know, Père Lachaise Cemetery or one of the great cemeteries, and you walk around, you will not find any tombstones that say he had too much fun. You know, you see people who die, and generally when people die, the things that they say was, I didn't spend the time I wanted doing what I thought was fun.
Yeah.
Or I spent too much time in marketing meetings and not enough time in museums. And that was when I realized, you know, it kind of all hit me, which is a better way to spend your money, having a big fast sports car that nearly kills you, or spending your time eating croissants and hanging out in French museums? And I went, oh, I'm going to fix my life.
Yeah, that sounds a lot better than, you know, trying to kill yourself in a convertible Honda Civic.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to kill myself.
No, I knew, yeah, almost killing yourself. Not on purpose, yeah.
Not on purpose.
Yeah, oh, man. All right. Well, listen, Marcus, this has been tremendous, and I feel like I have taken up way too much of your time. You should be out enjoying it rather than doing this, but I really appreciate it. And for people, if you happen to see Marcus at a conference, talk to him. Maybe he'll give you a $1 million idea. He might have a few.
I have several right now that I don't want to do. Actually, let me drop one if I can really quick.
Go for it. Absolutely.
So here's the thing. Yeah, I believe that you could come up with a zero systems administration layer that you could run on top of an operating system like Windows or Linux. Whoever does that is going to get bought for an incredible amount of money, or else they'll just make an incredible amount of money, right? So the objective should be a Manhattan Project-style effort to make a version of Windows. You got a management layer that sits on top so that everyone in the world who subscribed to your service is running the same perfectly functioning version of Windows.
Wow. That's it. There you go, kids. Yep. Get that.
Get coding.
There you go. All right, Marcus, thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Yeah.